is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Our goal is to save the family time and money and allow mom and dad to be mom and dad and enjoy the process and the player to focus on academics and performing and communicating to coaches and us as their advisor. That's kind of our process. And we placed every single 2023 kid that wanted to play at the next level 100%.
Steve Schaefer is the director of basketball at College Athlete Advantage. He was previously the head men's basketball coach at Augustana College in Illinois. Before Augustana, Steve was the head coach for 6 years at Benedictine University Mesa in Arizona, where he also served as the director of athletics from 2014 to 2020. He started the Ben U Mesa athletics department from scratch in 2014 and took the department from 60 student athletes and 8 club sports in 2014-15 to its present number of 325 student athletes and 13 intercollegiate varsity programs. Prior to starting the athletics program at Benedictine Mesa, Schaefer was the head men's basketball coach at Fontbonne University in St. Louis, Missouri, from 2011 to 2014. He also spent 2 years as the assistant men's basketball coach and athletic recruiting coordinator at the Benedictine campus in Lisle, Illinois, from 2009 to 2011. Steve also served as an assistant coach at both North Park University and Wayne State College.
Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Rob Senderoff, head men's basketball coach at Kent State University, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Take some notes as you listen to this episode with Steve Schaefer, Director of Basketball at College Athlete Advantage. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to welcome Steve Schaefer, the director of basketball at College Athlete Advantage, a recruiting service based out of Arizona. Steve, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. Excited to be able to talk to you about your background in the game, but also about what you guys are doing there to help high school athletes who are going through the recruiting process and helping them get to college, which we know in sports today, specifically in basketball, that a lot of kids have a dream of being able to play college basketball, and to have someone there to be able to guide them and help them through the process, I'm sure is incredibly valuable. And that's what we're going to get into and talk about a little bit as we move through your story. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball and what made you fall in love with the game.
Yeah, you know, what made me fall with the game was my dad. My dad played, growing up, he was a really good high school player in Ohio, in Bridgeport, Ohio. Went on and played at Virginia Military Institute and just got me kind of into the game when I was a young kid, and kind of coached me in the driveway and coached a couple of my peewee teams and stuff. And just got me really just engulfed with basketball. And then as I continue to grow, I'm 6'6 now, but I was tall for my age. So, naturally when you're tall, you play basketball. So just kept playing through junior high. I had a good high school career. And luckily I was recruited to play college basketball. I wish there was something like College Athlete Advantage right when I was in school. But I was fortunate enough to go on and play at Augustana College. in Illinois. And, you know, it just had a up and down career there, battled a ton of injuries, ended up having a career ending injury that forced me to hang it up, which is how I got into coaching.
All right, let's go back. Just talk briefly about your experience as a player, because you mentioned your college decisions. So let's start with high school basketball. What's your favorite memory as a high school player? Because I know anybody who's played high school basketball, you got something that stands out. So what was yours?
Yeah, I think there's two. Going undefeated my junior and senior year in conference was just an unbelievable achievement for our program and for our teams. So that was really neat to be able to win two conference titles back to back, going undefeated in our conference. I played at a small school. It was a small school then. It's a big school now, but it's Batavia High School, just outside Chicago. We had really good teams, and again, we were very fortunate to go back-to-back and win two conference championships. I think the most memorable moment I had, we were playing at the Elgin Holiday Tournament, the Christmas tournament. It was my sophomore year, and we were down 5 points, and we had the ball on the sideline. I caught it in the corner, got fouled, banked in a three from the corner, to go down one. So we were down four at the time. Got to the free throw line, missed the free throw, got my own rebound, made the jump shot. We won by one. So,
yeah, you had your Luka and Donovan Mitchell moment.
I did. Nice. It made the newspapers, and it was just, you know, being a sophomore, that was really cool to be on the front page of the sports page of your hometown and have a game like that. So that was really, really a memorable moment for me.
That's very cool. All right. So talk a little bit about your process of going from high school to college, what you remember about the recruiting process and just your college decision and what you experienced. And then obviously, as we go on, we'll talk a little bit about how that relates to what you're doing now.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's definitely changed today since when I was playing back in the mid-late 90s in high school. But for me, you know, I was fortunate enough to play 3 years of varsity basketball at a big school in Chicago, and that had a lot, you know, Chicago basketball, you get a lot of media, a lot of coverage. And it's very heavily recruited in that area at the college level. So we constantly had, you know, coaches watching our teams summertime, spring, during the season. And so I was recruited pretty, you know, heavily all 3 years of high school. I was getting a lot of letters from Division I programs, D2, D3. And again, as I continued to go through my 3 years of varsity basketball, I didn't get, you know, I was 6'4", 170 pounds. I finished at 6'5", 6'6", about 180 pounds. Physically, I knew I wasn't going to be a Division I player. And it's funny, in Illinois, you know, there was no Division II at the time, really, in Illinois. So you either went Division I or Division III. And so I chose to be a big fish in a little pond. You know, I kind of narrowed my choices down to Wisconsin Lacrosse, Millikan University, and Augustana College, or maybe prefer walk-on at Loyola Chicago. And I wanted to play. You know, my dad luckily kind of understood the process and was a player, and I wanted to play. So I chose small school over a walk-on situation. Had a Division II scholarship offer as well, but it was kind of farther away from home. I didn't want to go that far. So I chose to go to Augustana, and I thought it was a great decision for me. And, you know, it's funny, the best advice I got going through this process was from my mom. And she said, take basketball away. Let's say you get hurt. What school, you know, fits you the best personally, academically, and socially? Because, you know, you're not playing basketball every single day, you know, every single minute of the day while you're there. Your season's only from, you know, October to February. Make sure you're happy, you know, with all the other aspects of college. And I unfortunately got hurt. So, I mean, again, I love my experience. I picked the right place. And that was kind of my process as I kind of went through the recruiting world. So
what do you think is the biggest difference between what your experience was like then versus what a kid's experience would be like today?
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's schools just kind of started recruiting more on a nationwide level. I think, you know, in the mid 2000s all the way up until COVID, you know, you'd see, you know, my alma mater, you know, they were getting kids from Denver. They were getting kids from kind of all, you know, other areas of the country. And when I was there, I mean, our whole team was basically Iowa kids and Illinois kids. So we didn't really get a ton of kids from other places. You know, when I was the head coach at Augustana, we were getting into Arizona as well, and kind of utilizing our contacts nationally to recruit. And so I just think, You know, the AAU scene has just exploded since I was in school. And I think that's really, you know, that whole summer, spring live period, the shoe circuits. I mean, that's just changed the game of the recruiting process. And that's really the biggest difference to me is just those things.
How do you weigh out? I'm just curious, because we talk to college coaches, high school coaches. And so we get all these different perspectives about how recruiting runs through high school coaches and how it runs through AAU coaches and what coaches look for when they're watching a player with their high school team and what they're looking for when they're watching a player with their AAU team. And coaches have different opinions about which one they weigh more, which one they feel gives them a better, truer evaluation of the player. But I'm just curious from your perspective, with the coaches that you're talking to, with the players that you've worked with the experience that you've had being able to place players, and we're going to get more into your process here in a little bit, but just which of the two settings do you feel like in 2023 are more is more important or results in more players getting a college opportunity, or do you feel like it's still pretty balanced?
Yeah, I think it depends on where you live and where you are as it pertains to Arizona. And we work with kids all over the country, but as it pertains to the state of Arizona, I think that college coaches put more value on their travel team playing because I think they're just exposed to better competition. The state of Arizona, there's some good basketball down here, but I wouldn't say top to bottom 6A to 1A that there's a lot of great teams. And you look at the 6A right now in Perry High School with Koa Pete and Cody Williams and that whole group. I mean, they're just running through 6A right now, and they're not getting challenged night in and night out. So if you're a high major guy and you're trying to, you know, or you're a college coach and you're trying to evaluate their players, I think it's kind of hard to evaluate some of their kids based off the competition they're playing at the high school level. But as they transition into the AAU and club level, I think you're going to see a better level of competition with the teams they're playing on. So I think a lot of coaches at the college level put more of a premium on what they see from those kids during the summer and spring with their club teams.
Yeah, it's interesting. I never used to really understand that completely. And I think the more that my son's now a junior and the more you go kind of into it and you start to see what happens at all those different places, you start to see the value in what college coaches can see when they're watching a kid with their spring and summer AAU team. Because one, I know one of the things that college coaches say to me all the time is it's just so much easier to go and watch players in an AAU setting because I can go to one venue for 2 days and I can see 15, 20, 25, 30, whatever number of players. And again, depending on the level, you can just see so many more players. It's so much more efficient to be able to do that than to go watch a high school game where, again, you're talking about if you're recruiting a player who's going to be a college basketball player, chances are they're one of the better players on their team. And maybe you go and you see a game where it's a blowout and that kid only plays 17 minutes and he played 17 minutes against inferior competition. It's kind of hard to evaluate. So you can totally see where some coaches gravitate towards AAU. Certainly from a volume standpoint, it makes sense.
No question. And I think, too, you can watch the same player play multiple times in the same day, you know, in the spring and summer. Whereas if you go to a high school game, it's a 7 o'clock game, and you know you hope that he plays a lot. And if he gets 2 fouls in the first quarter, you kind of wasted your time.
So, right, exactly.
No question, yeah.
Yeah, it's just funny how I think, as you said, that shifted back when you were playing. Certainly back when I was playing, AAU didn't. It barely existed at all.
Yeah.
And now you get to a point where that's become really, really important. I know back even like 10 or 12 years ago, I'd have people that I knew talk to me and they'd say, oh yeah, we're missing this high school workout because we've got practice for our AAU team or there's an AAU tournament. We're not going to be able to make it to, you know, our high school open gym. And part of me, I always used to say like, I can't believe that people are missing their high school stuff for AAU. And as you start to be around both scenes a little bit more, you start to understand sort of the why, especially for kids who have aspirations of playing at the next level, the club / AAU team, you can see where it's definitely risen in importance in terms of what kids that want to get to the next level, why they need to be doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, I mean, again, I think it's, I don't love that it's gone that way. I just think there's, you know, high school basketball is so special, and you know, you grow up in your town and you grow up with these guys and you get a chance to play with them when you get to high school, and you know, you grow up watching that team play, and I just think that's been lost a little bit because of how big the club scene and the travel ball has gotten. And you know, but again, at the end of the day, times change, and you know, so do coaches, and coaches have to change with the times, and that is where you get the best bang for your buck when you're trying to evaluate players. There's no question about it.
I know that some high school coaches have expressed frustration to me on the podcast about, man, we've got some of our players being recruited and the college coaches never even call and talk to me as the high school coach, which I know the first time I heard that was from a local coach here in Cleveland a couple of years ago. And he had a player that was being recruited, and he's like, this kid, he tore his ACL when he was a junior, and he had some Division I interest prior to that. And then after he tore his ACL, the Division I's kind of backed off, and he ended up signing with a Division II school. And this coach told me, he goes, yeah, this kid's going to this school, and I never have talked to the coach. And that was probably in like late 2018, maybe early 2019. I remember being honestly flabbergasted, Steve. Like, I can't even imagine that a kid would get recruited and not the college coach would not talk to their high school coach at all. But now I've heard that story multiple times. And it's funny, the high school coach was right, because the kid went to this Division II school and did really well there. And then he transferred to Duquesne. And now he's actually at my alma mater, Kent State. And he's their best player and is playing really, really well. But it's just interesting to hear these stories that before he told me that, I never would have even believed or fathomed in any way, shape, or form that some kid would be recruited by a school and they'd never even bother to talk to the high school coach. They're just doing everything through the AAU program. It's just amazing to me how that shift has taken place. But you can understand it. As we just talked about, there are certainly reasons why that's the case as opposed to maybe what it used to be 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. And we actually see that a little bit, you know, situationally with our company. I mean, when we promote our players and, you know, we send their information out for them to college coaches, their high school coaches' contact information, as well as their club coach, a lot of times is in their introductory email, and they'll call me, you know, because they know me generally because I was a college coach and they want my opinion and things like that. But, you know, I've talked to some of the high school coaches because I try to keep them engaged with what we're doing with their players. And yeah, they're like, I haven't heard from any college coaches, but the kid might be being recruited by four or five schools that I've heard from. So it does happen. And it never used to be that way, like you said.
Yeah, it's very interesting. When you went to school before your injury, obviously you're focused on being a player. Was your thought when you went to Augustana that you were going to get into coaching? Did you have other ideas, or when did coaching kind of get on your radar? Did the injury sort of push you into coaching where you're like, hey, I just want to stay involved in the game? Or what was your mindset when you went to school?
Yeah, I never thought coaching was going to be in my future. I was a speech communications major and really wanted to kind of get into the corporate world and kind of do what my sisters were doing and my dad was doing and kind of go make money and, you know, have a life and things like that.
But what do you mean, have a life?
Yeah, have a life. You know, yeah, exactly. You know, it's when I got hurt, Coach Giovanni kind of pulled me aside and said, hey, we want you to come on and coach your senior year if that's something you're open to doing. And so gave it some thought. And I'm like, yeah, why not? I want to stay around the team and my friends and in the program. And I fell in love with it. I mean, I remember Coach Giovanni taking me to some of the summer tournaments that they go recruit at, and just sitting there and evaluating and kind of learning from him what they're looking for and how they evaluate players. And I just completely was hooked. I loved it. And it just, I never looked back from that.
What was the relationship like when you went from being a player to being a semi-colleague of your coach? Because I always think it's interesting for guys who get done playing in a program for a coach and then they transition, whether it's just being a GA or they have a situation like yours where they got hurt, or maybe they're at a Division III school and they get hired as a volunteer assistant, whatever the case may be, where you go from being a player in a program to being a coach and you kind of go sort of behind the scenes. Do you remember being surprised about some of the things that you learned about coaching in that first year?
Yeah, you learn so much being on the other side of the fence, and you learn a lot of the why. You know, why is coach doing this? Why does he do this? Why does he treat him this way? You learn a lot of that when you step to the other side of the fence and you're looking at it from the other lens, and you do. And that's the thing I learned about. It was such a wake-up call for me And I look back at myself, like, man, I was a very coachable sometimes, you know. So you kind of second guess how you were as a player, and
right.
you just learn a lot. And you know, it's also funny. I mean, now I'm trying to coach my peers, which is really difficult as well. You know, the young guys listen, but the other guys that are my age are like, hey, whatever, you know, I used to, you know, cross you over during practice, you know, 6 months ago. Now you want to tell me what to do, you know, so,
yeah.
But, definitely definitely a change and a, you know, but you learn so much, you know, when you're on the other side of the fence.
So it sounds like you knew right away within days, weeks that, hey, this is where I want to be. This is what I wanted to spend the rest of my life doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I remember, when the season ended, I asked coach, I'm like, hey, I want to do this full time. And, you know, what would be the best route to go? And he kept talking about go get your master's and let's look for some graduate, you know, school opportunities. And so I applied to 150 schools, and, you know, emailed 150 coaches and just said, hey, I'll work for free. I want to be a part of this. And I got two responses, out of, you know, 100 and some schools. And it was South Dakota State and it was Wayne State College in Nebraska. And, Coach Nagy was at the time, he was at South Dakota State and he said, hey, we're interviewing a guy that's been a former high school coach. He's got a ton of experience, obviously more than you. So, you know, it's kind of his job to turn down, but if you turned it down, I'd love to have a conversation with you. And so kind of concurrently, I was talking to Wayne State. So I went out, they brought me out there and did an interview. And, long story short, I was offered the job at Wayne State, and I took it, and it was a good move because the guy that, you know, that was kind of ahead of me at South Dakota State ended up taking that job. So it all worked out well, and, spent 3 years at Wayne State, got my master's, and then stayed on for a third year, kind of in a part-time role. I was the sports information director, / assistant basketball coach there. So, and I learned so much in those 3 years, under Coach Burkett and staff. So.
All right. So. What advice do you have for young coaches out there working for nothing and trying to gain experience? What's your best advice for how you made that work, how you managed it? What did you love about that period in your life, and what was the challenge about that period in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best advice I can tell a young coach who's getting into it is grind. I mean, you have to grind and you know, also, you know, don't be the guy that's got to be constantly told what to do and when to do it. You know, take some initiative and get things done and you know, just absorb everything you can and ask for more and just grind. And that's the way you become successful. But I think what I enjoyed the most about coaching at a young age, I love travel. I love recruiting. I love the road. I love getting out and watching players. And, I love, you know, breaking down film and I love practice. I just did. You know, the things that you don't love, you know, again, it's just, you don't have a life. I mean, I remember those 3 years, I was in the office at 7 a.m, 8 a.m, and was in there till dark and, you know, go home, watch film, eat, go to bed and do it all over again the next day. And, I remember driving to, you know, Des Moines, Iowa or, you know, Cedar Rapids, Iowa and not getting home till 3, 4 a.m. and have to get up and, you know, go to class at 8 a.m. So those were tough, but that's what you got to do if you want to do this, you know, do this type of career. So
what's something right from the get-go that you feel like as a coach you were pretty good at? And then conversely, what's something that maybe didn't come as naturally that you struggled with initially that you had to really work at to improve?
Yeah, I think the thing I was – the best I could develop relationships, not only with our current players, but with recruits. I thought I was a pretty strong recruiter, and knew how to sell, you know, a program and those types of things. I think what I really, once I got into the coaching side of it, the X's and O's side, I didn't know much. I mean, I just didn't understand, you know, how to read a defense and you know, if a team's, you know, hedging hard, what you should do offensively and, you know, how to guard a screen, the screener or, you know, things like that are staggered. I just never, you know, I never really retained that stuff as a player. So, you know, that was the biggest thing that I really learned. And I think today, if you ask me what my strengths were as a coach, I think it's X's and O's. I think I'm, you know, I can out X and O, you know, a lot of coaches out there because I just was very, very fortunate to work for some guys that were extremely good X's and O's guys.
Would you say that most of your learning X's and O's wise came from just the experience of the guys that you worked with, or did you have other places and sources that you went to try to learn the game?
You know, I think number one, it was the people I worked for. I mean, Wayne State College, I mean, our playbook was 100 pages long. It was unbelievable. We had an action. We had 7 different counters to that same action, and you had to, you know them all. You couldn't get on the floor and coach. So we had to take a test on our playbook. And I remember my first couple weeks on the job, Coach Burkett gave me 3 films of St. Cloud State and said, "Hey, I want you to break all these down and put together a scouting report." I've never done it in my life. And it was terrible, you know, and he said, "Okay, let's do another one. Let's do another one." So I was really lucky to have a guy that really tried to, like, you know, groom and kind of craft his assistants. You know, he gave us a lot of responsibility and he put us to work. And I learned a ton in those 3 years there. I tried to go to clinics and I'd try to sit, you know, I remember Don Meyer was in our conference and anytime I was on the road, recruiting and he was there, I would try to go sit next to him and just learn as much as I could from guys like that, you know, who are so good, you know. So those are kind of how I learned and grew as a coach, especially from the X's and O's side.
What's the most important thing when you think about your time as an assistant coach with Augustana and then Wayne State and then eventually move on to North Park in Chicago? What are some things that you learned as an assistant coach that eventually you took with you when you got your first opportunity to be a head coach?
Yeah. Well, I was fortunate to work for 4 different head coaches. So I think you learn what works and, you know, and what doesn't, you know, whether it be, you know, on the floor in practice, relationships with players, you know, building culture. I think the biggest thing that you learn is what works and what doesn't, because every coach does it a different way. And sometimes those ways work and sometimes those don't. So, I think the biggest thing I learned was how important relationships are. I mean, you have to build relationships, not only with your players, but with your staff, but also with people outside of your program. I mean, Coach Giovanni always told me, and other coaches did too, you need to treat your maintenance people and your computer technology people great. Throw them t-shirts and give them tickets because you never know what I could, you know, things like that that you just never think of as an assistant coach. Those things matter. So, that's the kind of stuff that I thought really helped me, as a head coach. And I'll tell you what, Mike, you probably know this too, being a coach. I mean, when you slide over to that first seat, it's different. It's a different situation. So,
yeah, there's no question. So I spent early in my career, I was assistant varsity coach for the first, I don't know, 13 or 14 years of my teaching career. Same staff for the majority of that time. And yeah, you're sitting there as the assistant coach. And, you know, then meanwhile, I'm the head coach of like my kids' travel teams. And as the assistant coach, look, I wanted to win as much as anybody. But when that game was over, I could kind of put that aside and just move on and be ready to coach the next day at practice and get ready for the next game. And yet, like coaching my own kids' teams as the head coach, you know, if we didn't have a game for 4 days, I was like, I couldn't sleep. I'm mm-hmm. replaying these. I'm like, all right, this third grade basketball game, I got to figure out what did we do wrong and what could I do differently? And so I can only imagine what it's like to be the head coach at the college level and to be able to take that responsibility. And again, that record is next to your name. And we've had so many coaches say that to us over the years that, and I was an assistant, I had no idea really what my head coach had to go through and do. I think even as an assistant, even when you're there in the office all the time and you're having those conversations, I still don't think, based on every conversation that I've had, almost everybody has an adjustment there that they're like, I didn't realize how different this feels just moving over that one seat on the bench. It sounds like that's the experience that you had.
No question. I mean, just working referees as an example. I mean, I remember when I was 30 years old and getting my first head job, I spent more time yelling at the refs and coaching our team some games. And, you know, as you look back on that, I mean, my last 5-6 years, I never spoke to the refs. And it's funny, when I was at Fompon, as I kind of, in my 3rd year there, I was talking to Jim Cruz. I used to go over and help them with their camps in the summer. And he told me a little trick that Rick Majerus used to do. And I took it and I used it, and it worked, by gosh. You know, he said he would never talk to the referees. And if he did, he'd ask questions. What did he do wrong there? You know, how can he be in a better position? And he would just be really nice to the officials for the first 35 minutes of the game. And then last 5 minutes is when he'd kind of get all over him, because if an official ever questioned that, Majerus's response was, well, the guy down the other sideline has been yelling at you all game. You know what I mean?
Right, exactly.
And, and I use that all the time. And I tell you what, that worked a lot. I mean, we got a lot of calls late in the game because I was nice to him down, you know, during the game. So it's like little things like that, that as an assistant, you never think about that stuff. So, I mean, it's just, you know, that's the kind of stuff you learn as you grow and become a head coach.
What was the most fun part of taking over your own program when you eventually got there to Fontbonne and you were able to be the guy and be able to make the decisions? What was the most fun part of that for you?
Yeah, I mean, everywhere I've coached besides Augustana was a rebuild. I mean, I walked into to nightmares, to put it somewhat lightly, and to be able to take that program that's got a bad culture and it's losing and turning it around. I loved that challenge, and every job I took, you know, whether it be an assistant coach or head coach, with the exception of, again, Benedictine in Illinois and Augustana as a head coach, that was what I walked into. So that was my big thing. I loved trying to take programs that were down and losing and turn them around.
What's the key to that?
Culture. I think you have to have great culture. The locker room has to be healthy. Kids have to be bought into what your vision is. And they have to stay the course and trust your process. That'll work. And if you can find kids that believe in that, and I think relationship development with those kids, not only on the floor but off, drives that, you can have success.
What does relationship building look like for you? Is it mostly informal, just through making connections and talking and having natural conversations, or were there some formal things that you felt like you did that helped you to build those kinds of relationships?
So in our program, we have four core values: integrity, commitment, unity, and passion. And we really hung our hat on those things, and we made all of our players establish three goals every year at the beginning of the school year: a personal goal, an academic goal, and a basketball goal. What I did, I had touch base meetings with our players every single month. So every month we'd have a touch base meeting, starting with the school, you know, the start of the school year all the way into May. And we talk about their goals and the season and basketball. We talk about their families, 15, 20 minutes, but we did it every month. And it was a chance for me to just build relationships with our guys and give them goals to achieve for the year, while, you know, carrying our values every single day, you know, why they were part of our program. So I just felt like, you know, when you develop core values and you put goal, you know, you make your players set goals and then you make them, you know, you hold them to those goals and communicate with them. I think you can develop really good relationship with your players, and it worked. I mean, our retention rates everywhere I coach was through the roof. So
how long were you?
I also think too, I mean, when you had, I was going to say, I also think, you know, I had JV teams, a lot of our rosters that I coach, we had 30, 25 guys. And I think you have to make sure that those 20 through 25 or, you know, 10 through 15 or whatever it is, they have to be valued and they need to understand, you know, that what they do every day for the program, even though it doesn't show up, you know, on Wednesday or Saturday nights at 7 o'clock. But what they do every day in practice, in the locker room, in the film room, in the weight room, matters. And there's a lot of value to that. And I would try to convey that to our kind of bottom end guys all the time, and make sure that our top end guys understood that too. And I think that really helped our roster and helped our locker room and helped those guys that don't get to play have some motivation and drive, because they felt like they were valued and they knew that everything that they did in practice mattered.
How would you do that? Like on the practice floor, in the film room, what are some specific maybe examples of things that you did to recognize those guys? So I think that's something that a lot of coaches, especially young coaches, I think struggle with, that is the ability to recognize, like, we can talk about, hey, player 12 is valuable on a 12-man roster, but it's a lot harder to convey that to a player. So what specifically did you try to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing we did, I mean, a lot of places that I coached, we filmed practice, and so we'd watch that. And doing that, I mean, everybody gets exposed in practice film, right? So that's where I think you can really celebrate those guys and their effort and some of the things that they do in practice. That's kind of the way I tried to convey their value to the team, or in practice in general, when they made a great play or they did something special. I also, you know, would try to get those guys to talk. Like we'd always circle up after practice, and I would try to get some of those guys to bring value to that circle and you know, provide some, you know, input and feedback to our team, you know, in their perspective. If a guy's not playing hard, and you know, we had guys that would call them out, you know, and say, "I wish I was in your shoes and playing 25 minutes a game, but I'm not as good as you. So, you know, don't take it for granted." And our guys, it was great to see some of our older guys who didn't play much, you know, do those types of things within our team. It was great.
Yeah, it's very cool that you kind of give those kids space to be leaders and to take on that role. Because I think one of the things that has sort of been a theme that we've talked with lots of coaches about is coaches so frequently say, "Oh, this team, we lack leadership, or we need to develop better leaders." But then coaches don't often give kids the opportunity to lead, or they don't give them the space to be able to lead, or the encouragement, or just teach them what exactly leadership is or what it means. And I think you just gave a really good concrete example of something that you can do to involve kids who maybe from the outside, nobody would say, "Hey, your 12th man is a really good leader on your team." But when you give them space to do that, there's kids that can lead in different ways. And obviously they can't necessarily, if they're not playing a lot, they can't be a leader necessarily on game day, but there's lots of other ways that kids can lead. And I think that's a really good concrete example of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So how does a Midwest guy end up out in Arizona with your next head coaching job?
Yeah. So kind of how all that played out. I was at Fompon University. It's the first day of practice, my third year there. And I feel like we got a chance to make a big swing in our program. We really had two really tough years. My first 2 years, I don't know if people know, but when I inherited that job, the coach had just passed away of cancer. We were on NCAA probation, and we had about four kids in the program, none of which played any significant minutes the year before. So we were starting over, just from scratch. So by year three, I felt like we had a decent young core of underclassmen that we can make a little bit of noise in the league, and at least. That first day of practice, the vice president, AD at Benedictine, came down, and he's like, "Hey, I'm in town. Let's go play some golf and after practice, if you have time, and go grab some dinner." And so we went out and played nine holes and went to dinner. He's like, "Hey, I didn't come down here to have dinner with you. I came down here to offer you a job." And I looked at him like, "What are you talking about?" So at the time, the Benedictine, Illinois campus was getting ready to build a satellite campus in Mesa, Arizona. And they wanted to start athletics, and they wanted me to be the athletic director. So obviously, I needed some time to think about it. We're going right into our season. I said, "Hey, I'd like you to give me till March to kind of, you know, figure this out and think about this. I want to, you know, my concentration right now is on our team and trying to get this team, you know, to win games and you know, compete for conference championship." And so got to the end of the season. We revisited and I decided, I think, you know, I love a challenge, and it was a chance for me to start an entire athletic department from scratch, which I've never done before. And I told them the only way I'm going to do it is if I can also be the head basketball coach. So they granted me that opportunity too. And in 2014, I took the car and drove it south to Arizona and became the head coach athletic director at Benedictine University Mesa.
So that's not a rebuilding project. That's a building project. That's even
a step
beyond
rebuilding. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So what was that like? What's it like to go from nothing?
Yeah, it was, I mean, we're selling kids on a vision, because we didn't have facilities. We didn't have teammates to introduce them to. We didn't have coaches in sports to introduce the players to their coach. I mean, it was a completely different experience than I've ever had in my life. But it was great. I mean, it was a lot of trial by error, and, you know, just kind of running around with your head on fire. But we made it work. We found facilities. We built our rosters. We hired coaches. We ended up applying to the NAIA and the California Pacific Conference and got full acceptance to both of them. And I think that really helped kind of really, you know, skyrocket not only recruiting, but our programs in general, because now we have an identity. You know, we play in the league and we are an NAIA program. And in our first year playing in the CalPAC, we weren't eligible for postseason play. We played 10 conference game and went 9-1. So, and then second year we won the league. So, we had some great success early on, in that league. And, you know, over the 6 years I was there, we grew the athletic department to be the biggest athletic department in the California Pacific Conference. We won multiple conference championships. Our men's volleyball team won a national title. And we had several All-Americans. I mean, it was just unbelievable to see the success we had so early on in our first 6 years. So it was a tremendous opportunity for me. And I look back on it just very proud of what we were able to accomplish with very little resources. We played off campus. The campus was two buildings. We didn't have a dorm until year three. And so we, I mean, it was like kind of like a junior college. You park your car, you go to class, go to practice, go home. You know, it was kind of one of those kind of situations. So we built a lot of our programs on junior college talent and sprinkled in some high school kids. So
who was your mentor when it came to the athletic department side of that? Did you have somebody that you reached out to as you sort of stepped into this?
I did. So Mark McCorney, who I kind of mentioned earlier on, who was the athletic director at the main campus, who's now a vice president at Benedictine, you know, I leaned on him a ton for a lot of guidance and things as we were building that. And he had a huge hand in the whole thing when it was developing. And he hired me, and the president and him are kind of, you know, those are the guys that hired me. And so I really leaned on Mark for guidance and mentorship as we were growing the department.
All right. So that leads us to your current stage of life. And obviously, as we just talked about, you have a ton of experience at lots of different levels as a college basketball coach. And then you also have this athletic department experience, which clearly can transcend just basketball. But now you're talking about being familiar with the process of bringing in athletes in other sports. So how do you get involved with College Athlete Advantage? What's the story there? Why get out of coaching? What was attractive about this? Let's start with sort of the why, and then we can get into the logistics of it.
Yeah, so my last year at Benedictine Mesa, I was getting burned out trying to wear two hats. I mean, it was really difficult to try to manage the size of our department, still try to grow that, and coach our team. And so Coach Giovanni retired in 2020, you know, that job opened up and I put my name in the hat for that. And you know, I thought that I never had a coaching only, position anywhere I worked. I was always the assistant basketball coach and golf coach, or the assistant basketball coach and athletic recruitment liaison, or the head coach and the women's golf coach. So, or the AD and the basketball coach. So I never had a job in college athletics that was just coaching. So this was an opportunity for me to go back to my alma mater and just be the basketball coach. And so I applied for it, and fortunately went through the process and was offered the job, and I took it. And so at the time I had a family in Arizona. And so they stayed here. I went up there and with the full intention of potentially them moving to Rock Island. And got through the first year, and it was COVID, and that was tough. I mean, I don't think any coach will tell you the COVID year was a really tough year to coach. I mean, there's so many variables and just, you know, challenges, and it took a lot out of everybody, I think, who experienced that. And I just remember we're playing Carthage. It's for us to be able to ensure a winning season, our 21st consecutive winning season in Augustana basketball history. We won in triple overtime. And I just didn't have a ton of feeling after the game. And I just told myself, you know what, this isn't fair to this team. And, you know, I think I need to look at trying to do something else.
The first training camp Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. An emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoopheads podcast and Joe Stecision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered.
During that time, I'd come back and see my family, and Mike Orchard, who's the president and CEO of College Athlete Advantage, I met him at where my wife works out. And so we got to kind of build a relationship a little bit, and he was telling me about College Athlete Advantage, and I think he knew that we were living apart, me in Illinois and her in Arizona. And so he offered me an opportunity to come into the company and start the basketball side of the business from scratch. They were, since 2018, that's when College Athlete Advantage began, they've only been a baseball company. So in 2021, they wanted to start expanding to other sports, and basketball was one that he felt would be a really good one to start. And so that's when he offered me the position to start the basketball side. So I had a decision to make, and, you know, I felt like, you know, I think basketball has run its course, and it's time for me to do something else. And it allowed me to get back to Arizona and be with my family as well. So that's what kind of got me out of coaching and back to Arizona.
All right. So talk a little bit about what your role is day to day, what it means to be the director of basketball at CAA.
Yeah. So, kind of what I do is, you know, I oversee the entire basketball side. We do have men's and women's basketball. We have advisors nationwide. Right now, we have 15 advisors throughout the United States. So what our process is and kind of what my job is to make sure that, you know, our advisors are finding players that are good enough to play at the next level. One thing that people really don't know about College Athlete Advantage, we don't take everybody. I know there's a lot of services out there. There might be 40 high school, you know, players at a specific high school program from freshman, JV, and varsity. And a lot of these services would take every single kid. And if you ask them, you know, how do you know if they're good enough to play at the next level? Their answer will be, well, we don't make that decision. We're going to leave it up to the college coach. And I just don't believe in that philosophy. I think that's taking kids down the wrong path. And so we treat this like a coach, where we go out and we watch players, and if we think they're good enough to play at the college level at some level, we want to go talk to them and their family and let them know how we can help them navigate and promote them to college coaches and navigate this recruitment process. So number one, we have a criteria that we have in order to take players into College Athlete Advantage. Number one, you have to be good enough. Number two, you have to be academically committed. Number three, you have to have a passion to play at the next level. And number four, you have to have a family that supports the process. So if you check those four boxes, we want to help you. So we already know, you know, the player's abilities before we even, you know, sit down on a Zoom or walk into their living room and talk to them about how we can help them. So that's a huge difference in what we do compared to a lot of the other services that are out there. So, you know, and I still work with families and I help kids. I'm working with about 75 players, mostly in Arizona. I have some kids in different pockets of the country as well. But, you know, we're helping hundreds of kids all over the country as a staff.
What's that onboarding process look like once you identify that a player has the capability to play at the college level, when you're sitting down and the family's making a decision about whether or not to engage you in the process? What does that look like?
Yeah, so our meetings are free. And we tell families, you know, if nothing else, you're going to learn a lot about the college recruitment process and everything that's going to be facing your son or daughter over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years. So that's number one. But we just walk them through our process. And our process is very unique. It's very personal. It's very customized because we believe no one's recruiting process is the same. So kind of our seven steps that we walk, you know, players through is, number one, we have that in-person meeting with them to you know, learn about them and what they're looking for in a college opportunity and learn a bit more about their basketball and academic background and their family. If they feel we're valuable and they want to move forward with us, then their second step is they're going to build their College Athlete Advantage profile. It's the right information that coaches want to see. So a blend of highlights and full games. We coach them up on how to make a highlight video because as former coaches, we know exactly what that should look like. You know, if you're making a 2 to 3 minute highlight video, the first 30 seconds better be really eye popping. If you're a 5'10 white kid and you can shoot it and you just have catch and shoot threes, you know, as well as I do, Mike, they can find that.
You're not going to stand out. Is that what you're saying, Steve?
Yeah. They're not going to watch 3 minutes of that. So, you know, we try to coach them up on that. We have all of their transcripts, their stats, their analytics, their high school and club coaches, contact information, pictures, their schedule. All that stuff is in their profile. Once that's completed, then we dig into all of their film and we put together a 9-point evaluation of their game. We don't assume that their high school or their club coaches are telling these kids in the off season what they need to get better at. A lot of coaches do, but a lot of coaches don't. So we don't assume that. we put that together for every player we work with as part of our process. So we grade them out on 9 different basketball criteria, and it's footwork, finishing, ball handling, passing, shooting, body and athleticism, basketball IQ, performance on the court, and projectability. So we're going to tell them, hey, these are the strengths in those areas, and here's some areas we can grow and get better. And it's funny, we had a kid that I worked with that was a junior that I thought was a Division III player, and he actually took the critical coaching we gave him, worked on the right stuff, and he's got a full ride. You know, he's a Division II scholarship player right now. So he did the right things, and it's mind-boggling to me, Mike, that no other services really do this to this degree. Because, I mean, how are you supposed to help a kid get better and increase his recruiting stock if he doesn't know what to get better at? So we believe the evaluation process of our process is really crucial to the process. The next step is we give the kids a values list. So they're going to rank 1 through 10 what's most important to them when choosing a college. And again, I don't know any other services that do this either. And again, it just kind of puzzles me, because how are you supposed to promote a kid to a college if you have no idea what they want? You know, if a kid from Arizona doesn't want to leave the West Coast, we're not going to promote them to East Coast schools. We'd be wasting our time. So we want to know what they want. You know, how important is academics? How important is playing time? How important is the relationship with the coach? Cost, location, campus life, the facilities, winning, level. So we want them to rank those things so we can work smart for them and target the right schools at the right levels that they can play at. So, you know, it's profile, it's evaluation, it's values list. We get together with a family over Zoom and go through all of those things. And the last two steps of our process, step 6 and 7, is we promote our players 5 different ways. Most services are going to, you know, they have the emails and all that stuff. We actually send the emails out for the player. We send emails as the advisor to the college coaches for the player. We promote them on social media, our website. And the biggest one, and why people use us, is our personal college coaching contacts. Our staff are all former college coaches. We make up over 120 years of college coaching experience from Division I all the way to junior college. So we know a lot of coaches. And again, that's a big way how we promote our kids. From that point, now our kids are starting to get opportunities. They're starting to get actually recruited. Phone calls, text messages, Zoom calls, things like that with college coaches. So then we sit back and act as their advisor every step of the way until they step on a college campus. So I'll give you 2 quick examples, Mike, of how we advise players. One is camp invites. And you know as well as I do, 75% of camps are money grabs, and you know, they're ways to pay their assistant coaches or fundraise for their program. So, you know, there's some colleges out there, they invite everybody to camp. And some kids think they're getting recruited by that school just because they got a camp invite, and that's not recruiting. So what we do is we try to sift through those camps. We provide them a camp invite response that they can email a coach that generally tells them whether or not they're going to get recruited by that school or not. It's really work for our kids. But more importantly, we'll pick up the phone and we'll call that college and say, hey, what are your needs for 2023? And if they don't say that kid's position, we call the parents back and say, hey, don't waste the money flying your kid there, getting the hotel room and paying the camp entry fees. They're not going to recruit your kid. So the amount of money we save families on camps more than pays for what we charge them to use our service. So that's one example. The other one's campus visits. You know, all of our kids are, you know, go on and visit campuses officially or unofficially. And we always say, what are you going to wear? What are you going to bring? How are you going to handle your cell phone? You know, mom and dad, what is your role in the visit? Because if you're talking for your kid the whole time, it's a turnoff. If you're talking bad about his high school coach, that's a turnoff. What are you going to ask the professor that you get to sit down with in the area study, or the coach when you sit in his office, or the players when you have lunch with them, or the tour guide? You know, those are things that most kids don't know what to do. So we give them all of that stuff. So they're not sitting around their coffee table for an hour before the day before the visit trying to figure that out. So our goal is to save the family time and money, and allow mom and dad to be mom and dad and enjoy the process, and the player to focus on, you know, academics and performing and communicating to coaches and us as their advisor. And so we, you know, that's kind of our process. And we placed every single 2023 kid that wanted to play at the next level, 100%. We had 2 kids that were Latter-day Saints, so they chose to go mission. So we reclassified them to 24, and we'll reactivate their stuff this summer and get them placed in 24. And we had a couple kids that got to the finish line, had opportunities at various levels, and just decided they didn't want to play anymore. So they went to a big school. So that happens too sometimes. And that's why we ask them how passionate they are about playing at the next level. So,
yeah, you definitely have to have a want to, right? I mean, there's a lot of kids that probably have the ability to play at certain levels, but I think
there are also kids that get to that point and they just say, hey, you know what? I'm ready to just go and be a student, and maybe I just want to play pickup basketball all day at a big school, which you can totally and completely understand. How much of the education piece when it comes to talking with families, how aware are families and kids of what the actual process is? In other words, when you're talking to these families, do they know a whole lot about what the actual recruiting process looks like, or are most of them still kind of in the dark about what the real process looks like?
You know, I think a lot of them are still in the dark on certain aspects of the process. I think a lot of families understand, you know, there's the identification process, then the evaluation process, then the communication process, and then you do visits and things like that. There's early signing, and then there's in-home visits and continued evaluation, you know, and things like that. I think they understand those things, but what they don't really understand, you know, is the difference between levels, the difference between an equivalency scholarship and, you know, and a headcount scholarship. They don't know the fact that all Division IIs and NAIs are not fully funded. They don't understand how the portal, how the COVID waiver year for juniors and seniors and budgets and things like that affect recruiting. They certainly don't understand that, you know, a lot of college coaches, especially at the scholarship level, are looking at transfers and JUCO kids and prep kids over high school kids nowadays. They're just not aware of those things. And so we really try to educate them on all those things. You know, we have a lot of kids that are high academic, and some of the families don't understand that there's early decision, you know, deadlines and there's early action deadlines and, you know, things like that that you have to go through. It's a different process. So we know those things. And so we're able to help guide the families correctly and through the process, regardless of, you know, what level they are and how high academic they're going and things like that.
What percentage of players and families, I'm just curious, have a realistic view of what level kids can play at? Because obviously there's the Division I or bust mentality that's out there. What kids are seeing on social media so often is this kid's signing there, or this kid has an offer from there. And understandably so, that's what most kids are probably aiming for. But I think there's a lot of, at least in my experience, there's a lot of people that have unrealistic expectations for what their kid is or where their kid can play. So how much of what you guys do, how many families do you have to sort of, and players do you have to sort of re-educate and say, hey, you might think you're going to be at this level, but you may need to look here instead?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. And, you know, 90% of our families are, and it's, I don't know if we're just fortunate with the families we work with, but 90% of our families have a very good understanding of who their child is and where they can play. We still have that 10% that think their kid's going to Duke, you know, things like that. But I think our background in coaching, the evaluation process that we put our players through, and being able to sit down on a Zoom call and going through that evaluation in detail with our players, and letting them know where we believe they can play at, that really helps families and players understand where they should go. And again, we are very honest and very blunt with our kids because they need to hear the truth. And we tell them in the front end when we sit down with them, you know, in our initial meeting, hey, we're not going to tell you what you want to hear. We're going to tell you what you need to hear. We're not going to lie to you. We're not going to lie for you. You know, we're not. So, we're going to tell you where we think you should go. And my thing is, like, we have kids that could probably go Division II, but do they want to play? You know, do you know what I mean? So we try to tell, hey, and that's why we have the values list. I mean, if playing time is really important, then you need to look at these levels because I think you can play at these levels sooner rather than later. So those are the types of things too that we try to use to educate the families on as to, you know, how to understand what level you should play at. So, and they listen to us. They know. I mean, we've coached at every level. We know what it takes. So,
all right. You mentioned earlier, if you're a 5'10" white guard that you just can't put catch and shoot threes on your highlight film. What things, if a kid's putting together a highlight film, let's just stick with the 5'10" white kid. You can go to any AAU tournament in the country, and you can look around at gyms and be like, there's 500,000 of these kids that are the same. I don't know how anybody differentiates between one or the other. So if you are working with a kid that you feel like has the potential to be able to play at whatever level, what are some things that you recommend putting in the highlight film, or what are some skills that you recommend kids work on at that particular
demographic, let's say, to be able to stand out to a college coach?
Yeah, well, before I answer that, my pet peeve in highlight videos are free throws. Never put, if we have any high school players listening tonight, do not put free throws on your highlight film. You're supposed to make those. No one's guarding you. Nobody wants to see a free throw. So don't put those in there. I think, with highlight videos, I tell all of our kids, no more than 2 to 3 minutes long. First 30 seconds have to be your most eye-catching clips. And I think what you have to do with that is put a variety of offensive and defensive clips in that film. Show them, show your ability to score in transition, to make a play in transition, to score at all three levels. Show yourself going. We have a girl that put together a highlight video. Everything's going right. You've got to show coaches that you can go both directions, finish through contact, go in both directions. I think it's really important that you put defensive clips in your highlight. Great on ball defense, charges, loose balls. Those things are really, I mean, coaches crave kids that want to put their body on the line and make those type of plays. So I think you just need to put a variety of different clips in your video and not just do the same. If you're a great shooter, that's great, but you got to show them that you can pull up, going left and get to the rim and, get a stop and, break down the defense and transition and make a play and come off a ball screen and read the defense and make the right decision. Those are things that I think are really important, and going to your weak side. I think that's really important too. Coaches want to see those things. So that's what we try to coach our kids on and in terms of, the highlight videos.
What type of player, and again, I know this is a loaded question and it may not even be answerable, but when you're talking to college coaches or you think about your experience, what's a type of player that is at the biggest premium, or what's the skill that coaches right now in today's game are putting the biggest premium on?
Yeah, I mean, right now, everybody that I talk to, they want 6'5", 6'6", or bigger, that are long, versatile, and athletic. And then I think the other one is shooting. Shooting's a premium, and coaches want guys that can shoot it, and they want long, versatile athletes. I think those are the two big things that coaches are looking for. And like every coach, the easy answer is post play. I mean, everybody needs bigs. But I think if you take the bigs away, because that's everybody, I think it's those other two players, those types of positions. So,
yeah, it makes sense. I mean, clearly when you have size, it gives you an advantage, and people tend to give you more looks the bigger you are. If you fit into that category where you're another 5'10 guard, there's a million of those. And like we talked about, then you better do some different things to be able to stand out. Whereas if you're a player that has some of that length and some of that athleticism, and maybe you can guard multiple positions, mm-hmm. it gives you a little bit more of an opportunity to maybe find a coach that'll take a chance on you just because you have size and maybe they can develop, even if you're not as skilled as maybe somebody else who's a little bit smaller. Just that size and athleticism can give you an advantage, I'm sure.
No question.
When you're talking to families, what's the biggest mistake, or maybe the most common mistake, that you see families and players making when it comes to their recruitment?
I think for parents, I think it's just a skewed vision of what their kid is. I think, we still have those families that think their kid is better than the level that's recruiting them. And our response to families is, you are the level that talks to you. You are the level that recruits you. If you're getting interest in phone calls and all those things from Division II schools, you're a Division II player. I mean, you're really not a Division II player until you get an offer from a Division II. But I mean, you are the level that speaks to you. I think that's a big one, for parents in terms of just misconception. And I think the other big misconception for both players and parents is the D3 level. They look at the price tag of those schools and automatically assume they're not going to be able to afford to go there, or that the basketball is not that good. And I tell these kids all the time, there's great programs at every level. There's great coaches at every level. There's great players. There's pros at every level. I coached in the CCIW for 6 years, and the best players in that league all had opportunities to go overseas and play if they wanted to. A lot of them chose not to because they had great jobs, staring them in the face after graduation that paid more money. So we have a slide in our presentation that we put together for our families that shows four facilities that are D2 and D3 versus four facilities that are Division I, and they don't know which is which. And we ask them, which ones do you think are better and would rather play? And they all say that the top ones, which are Division II, Division III, and the bottom ones are Division I. So We try to get it, that Division One or bust mentality out of our kids' heads. And we try to tell them, hey, you know, there's great scholarships at every level. I just talked to a coach today that just got a $4 million grant from a donor that is going to meet any high need kid that's a presidential scholar at that campus. So meaning they're not going to pay a dime. So that's a Division III school. And so we've had kids go through our process that have had D2 and Division III and NAI offers that have chosen Division III because it was cheaper than the Division II NAI school. So I always tell families, you know, you got to go through the process, apply, and see what a school can do for you, because you never know.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I think that's a huge misconception that's out there when people see the sticker price of a lot of Division III schools and they immediately back away. And my daughter, who started her, she's not a basketball player, but she just went to school and she's at a Division III school. And if you looked at the price tag of that school, you'd be like, yeah, there's no possible way that she could be going there, that I could afford it. But because of academics and the package that they were able to put together, it made it feasible for her to be able to go to that school. And again, she's not an athlete. So I can imagine that if she was an athlete and she was a high academic athlete, what the package that could be put together for a kid like that, I'm sure makes Division III very, very attainable for a lot of families that probably just at first glance would think, oh, I'm not sure that we could afford to send our child there. And I think that's something that, again, it's a misconception that's out there. I think the other thing that's interesting about the Division III level, and we've talked to a number of Division III coaches on here, Steve, about just recruiting kids and just the lack of knowledge about how good the level of basketball is at Division III. Like, they'll say, yeah, we talk to these recruits and 3/4 of them that we talk to they've never even seen a Division III game. Like, they don't really want to talk to us, but they have never even seen the high level of play that it is. I almost wish that you could just grab some random teams at an AAU tournament and be like, hey, just come to an open gym and play with some Division III college players and see what that's really like, and then make a judgment about where you want to go to school. I think we'd have a lot better educated players out there.
No question. And we always tell our kids, hey, they all stream their games. Go online and watch a game. I mean, you'll be surprised at how good they are. And I want to go right back to the scholarship piece for Division III and give you a quick story of a kid that we're working with. The kid is he's a 2.9, and he's a 30 ACT. And so he's committed to a small school. And when he initially applied with his 2.9, his academic scholarship was minimal. I mean, not very much at all. But the school is tuition driven and they've had, you know, some struggles with enrollment. So they asked the kid to submit his test score, which was a 30. And they accepted that, and they scholarshiped him off the better of the two scores. So they scholarshiped him off the 30 ACT, not the 2.9 GPA, and now he's a presidential scholar. Wow. So there are campuses that are doing things like that because they need enrollment, and they're going to throw some money at kids. And so Division III, I mean, obviously they don't give athletic dollars, but, I mean, they're doing some creative things to make it affordable for families. So, you know, for families out there that don't think Division III's are affordable, you know, you're wrong. There's a lot of schools out there that have great endowments and they're doing some creative things to make it affordable for families to go there.
Absolutely. I think it's, again, a misconception that's out there that there's just because they don't give athletic scholarships that you can't make it affordable, or in some cases completely free if you end up in the right place with the right time with the right coaching staff. It's certainly something that's not out of the realm of possibility, especially if you're a high academic kid, which if you could preach anything right to high school basketball players, or better yet, middle school basketball players, sit down and say, hey, take care of your academics from 9th grade to 12th grade, and you're just going to open up so many opportunities. I think kids don't necessarily understand how important that academic piece of it is.
Well, hopefully we have some kids on the call tonight, because I want to tell you guys and gals this. Understand, if you remember anything we talk about tonight, just a little piece of advice to the players listening. There's 5 times more money in academic scholarships versus athletic scholarships to the next level. For every 0.1 point your GPA goes up, that's 150 more colleges that can recruit you. But it goes the other way too. For every 0.1 point your GPA goes down, that's 150 less schools that can recruit you. So my whole point to that is, the higher your GPA, the more opportunity and the more money there's going to be for you in college.
Yeah, great. And obviously, just
you're getting yourself into a higher caliber school, obviously, the higher your grade point average. And there's compounding benefits to good academics, let's put it that way, that starts when you're young and it just continues throughout the rest of your lifetime as you compound those academic gains and everything that you're able to do with that. As you guys are talking to schools, obviously with your staff and the experience that you guys have as former college coaches and the connections, which you mentioned earlier, give you an easy opportunity to be able to build those relationships with college coaches. I'm just curious, as I'm sitting here as an outsider, not really knowing or being that familiar with the process, as you guys are talking with the college coaches and representing your players and promoting players, what's the relationship between College Athlete Advantage and the college coaches? And then what's the reputation in general of a recruiting service? So obviously there's two different things, your specific relationship with college coaches, and then just maybe what's the feeling with college coaches about recruiting services and their role in the whole process?
Yeah, so I'll start by answering the second part of that question. So, I mean, complete transparency, when I started this job, my biggest hesitancy was, wow, I'm going to work for a recruiting service. Because as a former 21-year college coach, I didn't put a lot of stock in the recruiting services that were out there. I mean, as a coach, you're getting dozens of emails from these services every day. And, you know, most of these kids can't play for you. They don't understand, you know, what it takes to play at your level. So, I mean, I only opened the emails if the kid was 6'5 or bigger or in our region or our state. You know, if they weren't, then I just deleted it. So I think the average open rate for a recruiting service basketball email is like 36%, 35%. We don't have a kid under 50% in terms of open rates on our emails. So, and I think, you know, again, the stigma of recruiting services is out there and it's not positive. And I think it's just because of a lot of, you know, past history of recruiting services and, you know, that type of thing. But in regards to my relationships with college coaches, it's funny. I mean, I was worried about that for the coaches I didn't know. But when we explain to them who we are and our background, it's refreshing to them. I think they really enjoy having a service that's out there that they can rely on to get honest feedback and actually good players. One of my advisors was at a showcase in the Midwest, and he was sitting next to a Division II coach, and he shook his hand and told him who he was and his background and what we do. And I'm not joking, Mike, the coach hugged him. The college coach hugged my advisor and said, where have you guys been for the last, you know? So I think for us as a company, I think our reputation is really solid with college coaches. And I think it's that way because they know we used to be them and we want to help them. So I think we're in a good spot with that. And I think that in the states that we are in and we've established in, I think people really, families and players and high school coaches too, they like what we're doing and they know we're helping and they're pushing their players to us. So, I haven't had to make a cold call in a long time because, you know, we've established down here and people want to use us because they know we can help you.
All right. So I think what I'm hearing is that you have trust on both sides of the equation, right? You have trust with players and their families that you're going to be able to do what you say you're going to do. And then conversely, on the other side of the equation, you have to have college coaches that trust that your evaluation and the players that you're sending or you're pushing towards their programs can actually play at those programs. Because as you described, when you were a college coach, you're getting all these emails and messages and things. And then when you do open them up or take the time to look at them, it's completely irrelevant because the player can't play at that level. So it's a matter of establishing trust on both sides of that equation. And that's where you start to build your reputation, really have this thing start to take off. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So what are the states where you guys feel like you have a stronghold right now where you're doing a lot of your work?
Yeah. So Arizona is a big one. Obviously, that's where we're stationed and that's where we started. We've got a really good presence in Oklahoma on both the men's and women's side. We've got two dynamite advisors in Tulsa that are doing a great job there. We've gotten into St. Louis in the Midwest, Wisconsin. We're doing some great things there as well. We're starting to get into Florida. We're starting to get into the East Coast a little bit, hired some people there. We just hired an advisor in Denver. which we're really excited about because there's not a lot of colleges there, and we have a really good person that I think is very connected to high school and college coaches that are going to be able to help players. And we're really trying to get up into the Pacific Northwest next. A couple things that we've been able to do in our time, in our 16 months of existence. We signed a partnership with NextPro. I don't know if you guys have heard of them. They're a scouting service that partnered with New Balance to have the fourth shoe circuit. I don't know if you knew that. I'm sure you guys knew that, the New Balance is now the fourth shoe circuit in the live periods for the club basketball in the summer. So we are going to be NextPro's sole recruiting service provider for all the New Balance shoe circuit tournaments in the spring and summer. So we'll be at all their events. We'll be at the Final Four as well. We'll have an exhibit down there. So college coaches come check us out and see what players we still have available. So we've got some really cool things going on with our company, and we're continuing to grow and add great staff members on both the men's and women's side. And we continue to try to grow.
All right. I want to ask you about the women's side of it. What are the similarities, and are there any differences between your approach when you're working with a male player versus a female player? Is there anything different in the process of what you guys do?
Our process is always the same. It's build the profile, evaluation, values list, maintenance call to go over those things, promote them, and then advise them. So process doesn't change. And again, it works for both sides. And that type of thing. So I do think that the levels, are a little bit trickier, on the women's side, from a promotion perspective. And that's something I'm learning, just being a 21-year guys coach. I'm really starting to kind of learn what Division I coaches are looking for when they're looking for girls. They want motor, they want speed, they want size. They want athleticism. That's what they want. I think the process really is different. I mean, basketball is basketball. We're going to promote the kid and highlight their strengths and let coaches know what they don't do well and see if they're fit to their program.
Absolutely. Makes sense. I mean, I think, as you said, basketball is basketball, and if you can play and you can find the level regardless of gender, that's really what it's all about, is trying to find the right fit for the player. We've talked to so many coaches that talk about you got to make sure that you find the right fit. And it sounds like your questionnaire, the survey that you put the players through and ask them to do their ratings, to me, that seems like, as you said, a critically important piece of making sure that you find the player the right fit. Because let's face it, you hear lots of, all you got to do is look at the transfer portal and realize the number of kids that maybe haven't made the greatest decision coming out about what school they're going to attend. And sometimes priorities of what you say you're prioritizing versus what you actually prioritize are different things. So I think if you can get kids like you guys are doing, thinking about all those things early, it's much more likely that they're going to end up with making the right decision. And obviously, if you can make the right decision, it ends up being a good one basketball-wise. It ends up being a good one academically, and it ends up being a good one socially, as far as going back to the advice your mom gave you, right? Take basketball out of the equation and figure out, is that a school where you could thrive even if basketball wasn't a part of it? And I think if you guys can help kids get to those kinds of schools, then that's really how you're going to be able to measure success. And then obviously the basketball career is right there as an important piece of it as well. As you look ahead and you think about where you guys are now and where you are right now with CAA, what do you see moving forward as your biggest challenge over the next year or two?
I just think the biggest thing is just, the portal is the biggest challenge. I mean, and I think for the next 2 years, the COVID waiver rule, those are our biggest challenges ahead of us as we place players and promote players to college coaches, because we've seen it happen already with our 23 class, where, a kid decides to take an additional year and get a master's, and all of a sudden that scholarship's not available anymore. And that opportunity's lost. And we've seen the portal play a huge effect in some coaches and what they decide to do with their roster spots. So those two things will continue to be the biggest challenges that face us. But I also think because of that, a system and a process and a service like us is more needed now more than it ever has been. because you have to cast a wide net and create opportunities. Because, you know, if you just, you know, limit it to your state, you know, I tell kids all the time, it's like applying for a job. If you only apply for two jobs, you may not get a job. But if you apply for 100, there might be one out there that fits. So, and you might get an offer. So for that job. So I think recruiting is kind of the same way nowadays with the way, you know, the process is unfolded. So that's the two biggest things that I think face and challenge us as we move forward.
All right. What's your biggest joy about what you get to do every single day? You coached at the college level for a long time, make a career change. I can tell that you're passionate about what you're doing, but just tell me a little bit about your biggest joy.
I mean, helping kids. I mean, I love helping players. That's been my biggest joy. And so to help these kids and these families through this process and get them to the finish line is by far the biggest joy that I have doing this job. And I would say the other thing that I love is exposing these kids to schools that they may never have heard of or even know about, and they fall in love with. That is so fun to do and to see and to watch and to develop. So those are those are my two biggest joys, waking up every day and doing this job.
Well said. All right, before we wrap up, Steve, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, how people can learn more about College Athlete Advantage, website, social media, email, whatever you want to share. And then once you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, so they can contact me by email at Schaefer, S-C-H-A-F-E-R, at collegeathleteadvantage.com. You can go on our website and learn all about our company and our process and all the sports that we offer at www.collegeathleteadvantage.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, on Instagram. We have Facebook and LinkedIn as well. We're very active on Twitter and social media. Feel free to DM me on social media as well. We look forward to hopefully continuing to help a lot of players throughout the country with their college basketball recruiting.
Absolutely, Steve. This has been really informative, I think, for any players, parents, and even coaches out there who are listening. I think that the process that you guys go through is one that's very thorough and one that can have tremendous benefit for players and their families and helping to aid them in the recruiting process and help them, as we talked about throughout the night, to find the right fit for them, both from a basketball standpoint, an academic standpoint, and a social standpoint, to find that right school. So again, can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to join us tonight. Truly appreciative. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.